Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. This is a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Claire Donato, and that's spelled C-L-A-R-E-D-O-N-A-T-O. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Claire. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Great. Claire, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
You may.
Thank you. Claire, what year were you born?
I was born in 1957.
And where were you when you were born?
Charleston, South Carolina.
Okay. How'd your dad meet your mom?
In college.
Okay. What were they studying?
Well, he is a doctor, and she was probably, you know, liberal arts, English literature, stuff like that.
Okay. So there's must be a med school there in Charleston?
Yeah.
Okay. When did they get married?
Well, I think it was around 45. That's kind of a guess. My sister's much better at the family history.
Did your dad serve in World War II?
Well, I think he served. I don't know for sure, but I think he was in the armed forces at one point.
Okay.
But I don't really know that history. I know his dad, you know, because my father was born in Germany. His dad was Italian and came over when he was 12 to New York. And he went to war and met my grandma, who was German.
Okay.
So my dad was born in Germany, and after 3 months, I know they moved over here, and I think they were stationed in Sullivan's Island, which is a barrier island outside of Charleston.
Okay. And did you have any older or younger brothers and sisters?
Yeah, two older brothers and one younger sister. My brothers are like 8 and 10 years older. And then my sister's 2 years younger.
Okay. And did you grow up then in Charleston?
Yeah, the Isle of Palms, really, which is another barrier island. So I was a beach bum.
Okay. So did you learn to swim in the ocean then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
I mean, I probably actually learned in a pool, but I swam in the ocean quite a bit.
Okay. So in the 60s, did you all do the typical kids in the station wagon were going for a couple week, you know, drive around the country kind of thing or not?
No, I don't really remember going. Mom took us a couple of places. They divorced when I was 10.
Okay.
So my dad would take me and my sister to see his family who lived in Columbia, South Carolina, his sisters and their families. And Mom took us on a couple of trips. We went to Washington, D.C., the Smithsonian, and Six Flags over Georgia type of thing.
Okay. So not much travel outside of Carolina, South Carolina?
No.
Okay. And on the weekends and such, when you were growing up, were you pretty much, you know, get free reign of the island there?
Yeah, I pretty much lived in my bathing suit. We had a house right on a tidal creek, so we had a dock out there, and I could crab and fish and play in the water.
Nice.
And my father had a boat, and we'd go deep sea fishing. And
oh, wow.
So, yeah, I lived in the water pretty much.
Okay.
And then when I got my first horse, I was 10, and
When did you first become attracted to horses?
Well, I was like 6 years old, I think, and on the island we had the little carnival that would come every summer.
Okay.
You know, rides and stuff, and there was horse rides there. And so my mom took me down, and I wanted to ride a horse, and so I did. And then later that day, I wanted to go back and do it again, so she made one of my brothers take me. And then after that, I was down there every day.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I caught the horse bug for sure.
Cool. And then you mentioned your dad got you your own horse when you were 10.
Yeah, when they got divorced, I guess he thought, I was always daddy's girl for some reason, and when they got divorced, I had been keeping money in a sock under my bed for I don't know how long to buy my own horse, and so he bought one for me, and they, I guess, take my mind off of things, but unfortunately, okay, it made things harder for my mom, because we couldn't keep horses on the island anymore.
Ooh, okay.
And so I had to board.
Okay. And so that meant you had to leave the island and go to the mainland?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And so mom would have to take me.
Okay. Yeah, because, well, you were only 10, 10 or 11.
Right.
Were you able to keep the horse?
Yeah, I kept him. We had to put him down eventually. I think I was 17 or 18. I had gotten another horse when I was 17, and so I made my sister get into riding so I didn't have to get rid of Oyster.
Okay. And did you learn about how to care for horses during those years, you know, clean their goop out of their, on their hoofs and brush them down and feed them and, did you get into all that?
I did. Like I say, I had to board, but I definitely learned how to do that stuff. And then before I got my horse, like during the winters when the carnival wasn't there anymore, my mother set me up with horseback riding, so I kind of got a formal instruction for riding. And
okay.
Yeah.
Nice. In high school, did you compete in any sports at all?
No, just I competed in horse shows.
Okay.
I got into show jumping and.
What was that like?
Oh, that was great fun. So.
And
yeah.
How old were you when you first did your first show?
Oh, I don't know. Because I probably, once I got my horse, 10, I might have been in shows before that, just riding, you know, the rental horses at the stable.
Okay. Well, you would have been, you know, nice and light, and I would think you had the chance, actually, to clean house.
I didn't do too bad.
Okay.
Then when I got my second horse, you know, they were pushing me into getting a thoroughbred, which is the, you know, breed that was mostly doing the show jumping, but always off on my own little path. I got like a Appaloosa quarter horse.
How'd that work out?
It worked out okay.
Cool.
I got some prejudice, I guess, you know. Horse people can be kind of snobby. So.
Huh, okay. I know nothing about it. And since I know nothing about this, I haven't talked to anybody who's a horse show jumper. What else do I need to ask you about that?
I don't know. You know, there was some tumbles, I suppose.
And but, did that hurt you and the horse?
There's a couple of times when the horse and I both went down, but we were fine.
Okay.
But yeah, mostly it was just me, you know, he'd launch me over the jump.
So the horse would, like, head to the jump and then stop, and you'd kind of make the jump without the horse? Is that how that would work?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay. And I'm assuming that happened enough that you were, in quotes, comfortable with that.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a kid, so I was fearless. I wouldn't be comfortable with it now.
Well, yeah, understood. And were you doing that then? Yeah, you were doing that through high school. Huh.
Yeah.
Did you travel the South doing that outside of South Carolina?
No, but we pretty much traveled the state.
Wow.
So we'd go to Columbia. Actually, probably Columbia was the farthest off, but and all around the Low Country area.
And did you get to know the other excuse me, did you get to know the other horse jumping people?
Sort of. There's pretty much the same people,
Okay, same
but
group of people going from event to event.
pretty much.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and the gal that I who was going to high school with me and her parents owned the stable that I boarded at.
Ah.
She ended up getting an Appaloosa as well, and then we started going to the Appaloosa circuit. So then I was showing both English and Western, and so that was different. So I started getting into a little Western riding.
Okay, so explain, could you please for me the difference?
Well, the gear for one, the Western saddles, have a horn and have a lot more material to them, heavier, more like a cutting horse would wear.
Okay.
And then the English saddles, are the little ones that you can, sort of like jockeys, but a little more than that.
I mean, you wear with knee-high boots and a little hat and
Yep.
okay. And it seems as though the cutting horses, their job, their workhorses, their job is like to have you lasso a calf.
Yeah, or cut a cow out of a herd.
And so were you starting to practice with a rope to do that stuff?
No, I just pretty much did the walk, trot, and canter sort of a thing.
Okay.
It wasn't till, gosh, recently, like 2013, that I started getting into cutting cows out of the herd and stuff with my with my mule.
Okay.
So,
Okay.
after I retired.
Wow. Okay. So that means you had two sets of tack. And would you use the same horse for both the English and the
Yeah, I did.
okay. And your horse didn't seem to mind?
No, he likes jumping, so
Okay.
well, one of the judges told me that I should probably pick one or the other so that I could, be good at one instead of mediocre at two.
Well,
So I picked jumping.
okay. Which is the English side?
Yes.
Okay. And did you get good at that?
Fairly good.
Okay.
We were making the rounds. I collected a few trophies and
Wow. Nice.
yeah.
And then did you go to high school there on the Barrier Island or off in Charleston?
Well, yeah, there is no school on Isle of Palms. There is an elementary school on Sullivan's Island, and we went there.
Okay.
And then, yeah, high school was in Mount Pleasant, which is before you get to Charleston.
Okay. You mentioned that your elementary school was on Sullivan Island. Was there a bridge connecting the island you were on to Sullivan, or did you get on a boat every day to go to school?
No, we had a bridge. It used
Okay.
to be a boat, but I never, that was before me.
Okay.
So we had, yeah, one bridge. Now there's two bridges, but it was just one bridge off the island.
Okay. And then for high school, how did you make that work? There a bus that picked you up on the
yeah.
island and
Yep, we had buses.
okay.
And then later it was friends with vehicles.
Okay. Yep. Was it assumed in your family that you would go to college?
Absolutely.
Okay. And
Much to my chagrin, actually, because I had graduated high school a year early, and I was getting my another horse, and I wanted to take a year off and show him and then go to college with the rest of my class.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't getting another horse unless I went to college.
How did you get a year ahead of the rest of the pack?
I had good grades, and then I found out there was a friend who did it with me that we could just take the senior English class over the summer, and we could go right from sophomore to senior.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's what I did, because I was not a big fan of school.
Okay.
I wanted to ride.
So, well, I get a sense that you were really bright. I mean, you weren't stupid. But that school couldn't maybe keep up with you to keep you challenged?
I don't know, maybe.
Okay.
I lived after school every day. I went to the stable and rode, so.
Okay.
That's what I lived for.
And I'm assuming that from the stable, were you riding on the stable grounds, or would you, like, you know, head down the road and over the hills?
Yeah, we had trails. The stable was always far enough out. Had to keep moving out because subdivisions creep in.
Sure, okay.
But, yeah, the last place I kept him was Great Trails. In fact, it's a state park now. But, yeah, we could go swimming with the horses. And, it was fun.
I bet the horses like that.
Well, it was, you know, pretty hot down there, so they probably enjoyed it.
Yeah. So maybe there wasn't only an expectation to go to college, but was there an expectation to be a doctor? I mean, this would have been the mid-70s, I suppose, mid to late 70s, and you know, that the whole concept was changing about women either being teachers or nurses or homemakers.
Yeah, I didn't really know what I wanted to be.
Okay.
I thought about maybe an oceanographer, maybe a veterinarian. I didn't know.
Okay.
So I didn't like school, so I didn't want to spend a lot of time in school. So I started out going to the College of Charleston. And it was like too close to home.
Okay.
And my entire family had gone to the College of Charleston. So it was like everybody knew my family. And then then there's that expectation to live up to.
Yeah.
So I managed to transfer to University of South Carolina in Columbia. And that got me a little farther away. It was a bigger school and nobody knew me. And
okay. And were you in the dorm then?
I was in the dorm.
Okay. And what were you doing with your horse at the time?
Well, I brought him with me.
Okay.
And he stayed at a stable close by.
All right.
But I had to work, and so, because I was told that my parents were no longer supporting my horse habit. So.
Oh, wow.
So I had to get a job, and that paid for his board.
Yeah, but that had to be tough because you were now working a job instead of riding a horse.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, I could cut school a lot.
Okay.
You know, the USC was pretty easy because you could show up on the first day. You could get the agenda for that semester or whatever. And then I would just make sure I knew the material, showed up for tests.
Wow.
And kind of get out of there. But that's where they had a little job service place. And I would sit in there and I would flip through all the potential jobs that were out there.
Right.
And I came across a packer, an animal packer. And in fact, there was a job opening in Glacier in Montana.
Wow.
And I said, whoa, I could could do that. And so that got me interested in that line of work.
So this would have been in 76 or so?
Yeah, because I graduated in 78.
And that Packer job was a summer job?
Yeah.
Okay.
Glacier has a pretty short season, I think.
Had you been out to Montana before?
No.
Okay. And so did you apply for that job?
I think I did, but you know, I didn't really have any experience. I could ride, but that was it.
Right. Did you get it?
No.
Huh.
But that got me on that track of thinking, but.
Okay. What were you doing for your summers there? Well, actually, what were you doing year round? Because you clearly were smart enough to. I was in college, and I envied you people.
Well, my heart was definitely not in school. But when I was at school, I was working in a sandwich shop.
Okay.
And I paid for my horse's board. My horse ended up dying, he got colic and twisted his intestines, so.
Oh.
Then I wasn't going to be able to afford another horse, so I was kind of horseless there, and, so I basically would lifeguard,
okay.
During the summer, lifeguard and teach swimming.
Oh, okay.
And, I had gone off one summer. I went off to Clark Hill Lake, which is, I think, called Strom Thurmond Lake now, but it's on the border of South Carolina and Georgia.
Okay.
And there's two state parks there. So I was lifeguarding there, and I met another lifeguard who's from Greenville, South Carolina, and we became good friends and sort of stayed in touch.
Cool. What did you end up getting your degree in at USC Columbia?
Sociology.
All right. I mean, was that just to get a degree in something, or did you actually, you know, have any interest in that?
It was just to get a degree in something, and it was material I didn't like to read.
Okay. All right.
So, and the psychology and all that stuff.
Yep. So this would have been 78, and were you thinking, I mean, was your family thinking, okay, master's, PhD?
Yeah, they probably were.
Okay.
Because you weren't going to do anything in sociology without a master's, at least.
Right.
But, no, I asked my mom, I said, are we good now? I've gone through college, are we good? And she reluctantly said yes. And so I went out and got a landscaping job. They were developing the end of the island into what is now Wild Dunes Resort.
Hmm.
And so I was in on the beginnings of that until my direct supervisor told me I had wrapped my shirt up. The guys had all their shirts off.
Right.
And I'd wrapped mine up like a bathing suit top.
Yeah.
And he told me to put it down, and I said, why? And he goes, because it's distracting. And I said, well, distracting to whom? Because those guys have their shirts off.
Right.
And he says, well, you need to put it down or you can leave. And so I threw my rake down and said bye.
Okay. Good for you.
And then... Yeah, well, and then that night, went to the bar and got a job as a carpenter's helper.
Okay.
And he said all he wanted me to wear was boots.
Okay.
So as long as I had boots on, I had a job. So, of course, nice. I wore more than that.
But. Yeah. I want to kind of go back to the family scene for a minute. You had two older brothers. Were they married by then, by the time you were done with college?
No. think Chris was. Chris didn't want to go to college either, so he ended up joining the Army and then volunteering for Vietnam.
Okay.
To get out of school. My brother got deferred because he was getting his PhD in chemistry, of all things.
Okay.
And so he was in Charlottesville, and that's where he met his wife, whether he got married then or not, and I'm not sure. So, well, but they were pretty much gone from home, so yeah. It was just me and my sister.
Okay. And at least your mom was, you know, good enough about it to let you go.
Yeah. Well, and I had moved out of the house, too. I had moved in with some friends.
Okay. So you got a job as a carpenter's helper. Was this building houses?
Well, we were renovating this restaurant.
Okay.
And I was hoping to get into building houses, but after we were done with this restaurant job, we didn't have any more work for us. It was a friend of mine that I'd been living with. She was with me, and we were both the carpenter helpers.
Okay.
And we were going, well, what do we do now? So she said, well, her mom was living up in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and that maybe we should go up there. So we did. And she got a job as a waitress, and I got a job on a construction crew. I was on the ground level of building a real big Bell telephone building.
Okay.
So that was a whole new phase of construction that I got introduced to.
Which was steel girders and concrete blocks or?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I ran into a little bit of resistance on that job because I was the only woman there. But overall, my supervisor was wonderful. But the rest of the crew had some problems. And they had no problem telling me that, you know, it's like, too bad. So I got to, well, the first day, I got hired on with two black guys. And we had to go down into where all the steel had been tied for waiting for the concrete.
Okay.
And it was delayed for some reason. And I never really knew if this was a test or what. But anyway, I had to crawl down into the cage and scoop up all the dirt that had sloughed down from, you know, because it had to wait so long for the cement.
Got it.
And then haul it up by the bucketful to the people above. And I did that all day.
Okay.
And at the end of that day, they said, well, they fired the two black guys and they gave me a raise.
Okay.
So I worked there. I think I got tired of doing the commute. It wasn't really that far, but, you know, I was in sort of a party mode.
What kind of vehicle did you have?
Oh, a Volkswagen Bug.
Okay. that was a popular car at that time.
Yes, it was. That was my first car.
Cool. Did you get good at pulling that engine out and working on it?
No, I didn't start doing that until I got my truck.
Okay.
But yeah, I ended up driving it out to Grand Canyon.
VW Bug?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But
so you're on the job site, past the first day of schlepping out dirt around around rebar, and they kept you on.
Yep. And then I had to make all the mud for, you know, the mortar for the brick masons and carry this. I learned how to tie steel, but boy, it was pretty slow. Those guys are fast.
With pliers and steel wire ties, tying rebar together, and then you know, if you're making mud, you've got to, for block layers, you've got to make that right. They won't
and
want
I had
it.
to hustle.
Yeah, and then did you have to keep them in block too, or just mud?
No, I just had to keep them in mud.
That's busy. Okay.
Yeah, and I had to be the perfect consistency, and I had to get there on time. You know, I had to mix it and then wheel it over to them, and you know.
And yeah, as that building got higher, did you go higher as well with your mixer and sand and all that junk?
Well, I didn't last that long. I ended up quitting that job probably after about 6 months.
Okay.
And then I just kind of bounced around a little bit. I got a waitress job, which I'm not fond of. And then I got another landscaping job. And nothing was, you know, was, you know, talking to me. And anyway, I ran into this guy who had a swimming pool on like 10 acres of land with a little clubhouse and everything that he was letting like church groups use, and he needed a lifeguard. And I went, well, there you go. And he goes, if you want to, you can set up your own swimming lessons. And so I set up a schedule for swimming lessons from beginner, you know, from little kids to adults. And so I spent the rest of the summer doing that.
This is 78 or 9?
Oh, it must have been 79, because my friend that I had gotten to know from Greenville, who was also a lifeguard, she had gone out to Grand Canyon and gotten on with the YACC.
Oh.
And we kept in touch with letters, and she wrote me and said the trail had washed out and they were hiring people out the yin yang, so get out here. And I went, well, I have to finish my my duties here at swimming, but that'll be over, you know, when the kids went back to school.
August, something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I finished that up, moved back home. My oldest brother was out at SMU in Dallas. So my mother and I went, my sister must have gone too, but I went out to Thanksgiving with him, and he was definitely married by then. And then from there, I got on the bus and went to Grand Canyon.
Was that your first time west?
Yeah.
And you didn't drive your little VW?
Not yet.
Okay.
I ended up going back and getting it, driving it out.
Okay.
But right now, and Carolyn picked me up in Phoenix and drove me to the YACC camp.
So the you would have taken the I-10, I guess. I'm not sure. Yeah, maybe I-10 up to through El Paso and over to Tucson and then up to Phoenix.
Yeah, I guess so.
And then she'd have picked you up, and then you'd have left the desert and gone up on the Mogollon Rim up the Flagstaff with pine trees.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
It was all pretty. I was, you know, in culture shock. And then, you know, but it's like as soon as I got off the bus, it was like all the moisture left my body. Because, you know, I knew nothing but humidity.
Right.
I had the heat down, but this dryness was different.
I bet.
So
what was the YCC about? What was that, and how did that work?
They, you had to be under 24 years of age.
I'm going to jump in again. I'm sorry. Is that the Youth Conservation Corps?
Young Adult Conservation Corps.
Okay. And who was operating that?
You could be a little older. You know, I can't remember his name. But he also cooked for us. We had our own camp there. And the way it worked was they would farm you out to different, you know, if you could go backcountry ranger, you could go into maintenance, you know. And, you know, you could pick one if they had openings for it. And so I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. I think Carolyn was a backcountry ranger. And I thought that sounded pretty good, but then I found out about the trail crew, and they had mules and rode and packed. At that point, the trail crew packed all their own gear. There was a packer there, Dave Smith, but he mainly packed all the feed down into the canyon where the trail crew was going to stay with their animals, and then packed the blue goo from the toilets out.
Okay. So they were actually packing at that time. This would have been 79. The winter.
Yeah, I was there in December 79.
Okay. And so they were packing out the blue goo from the bathrooms at the campground?
Yeah, well, there's a bathroom station along the way, too.
Okay.
A couple of them. But, yeah.
Huh? What? I'm assuming he had like five gallon jugs that would like fit into some sort of fittings with some kind of valve.
Well, he had like dry bag sort of a thing, seemed like, and I don't know if they pumped it into that. I'm not sure how that worked. It was before the composting toilets.
Right, and before the sewage treatment plant was built down at Phantom, eventually.
Yeah.
Huh?
So, yeah.
Okay. So did they have an opening there on Trail Crew?
They did, and when I was asked, I can't remember his name, but he said, well, what division do you want to go into? And I went, how about trail crew? And I just remember him looking at me like he'd just eaten something nasty. And he goes, well, bring a lunch. You can start tomorrow. And because I guess trail crew is where you went if you were misbehaving.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Or you needed to be humbled. So. Uh-huh.
And you'd already, I mean, you'd already done construction, and you clearly liked it. And they had stock. I mean, gosh,
yeah.
what a wonderful combination.
Yeah, I was in 7th Heaven.
Wow.
So, yeah, the first, I'd never been around a mule. But,
okay. What differences did you see right away between the mules and the horse, the Appaloosas and the... You know, the horses that you were familiar with.
Well, most obvious, you know, the ears. But their body build was a little more donkeyish than a horse.
So stronger, stockier, what?
Yeah, they were all that different, you know.
Okay.
But, the first day I started with another guy, a young skinny black guy, and he was on trails because I don't know what he had done wrong, but he was on trails as a punishment. And they gave us each a halter and told me to go catch that gray mule because they wanted to see how we would do. And they told him to go catch one of the other mules, and he was scared to death of them, you know. Big 1,000-pound animal.
Yeah.
And I went right up and caught the gray mule, whose name was Cutthroat. And so I passed that test.
So how do you catch a mule? A mule's clearly in the pen, so you get in the pen. Do you just, like, walk over to it and talk to it and say, hey, Cutthroat, you know, my name's Claire, how are you?
Yeah, well, you know, I usually approach at the shoulder so you don't, you know, threaten or intimidate him.
Mm-hmm.
by coming at their head, and you don't push them by coming too far to their butt.
Right.
They come up to, you know, I watch how she's reacting to me, and, you know, she was used to getting caught, so.
Okay.
Then I went up and put my arms around her and put her halter on.
Oh. Nice.
Yeah. And then the rest of the day, I got to brush them and saddle them, and we rode down to the dirt pit.
Okay. So packing with mules is way different than jumping. Had you ever... I was going to say, I'm like, how do you keep from, I mean, just your load swinging around to the mule's belly, and, you know, how do you keep from getting stomped on? And it just seemed like it would have been a real different world. Who was teaching you? Who was mentoring you?
Well, Pete Howard was running the crew, and Stanley Sloan, who is Navajo. These were my first Indians I ever met, too. There was Stanley and Tillman. And then...
Sorry, was that Tillman?
Tillman. I can't remember his last name. Stanley Sloan.
Okay. All right.
And there was Candido Apodaca.
Can you spell that? C-A-N-D-I...
Yeah, C-A-N-D-I-D-O, I think.
Yep.
Candido. And APO Apodaca. DACA? I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
But I think his father was working in maintenance. They were a nice Mexican family.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dan Blackwell was on the crew.
Okay.
Who went on to be chief of maintenance at Sequoia Kings.
Right. And was Dan working as a packer then on trails?
Trail crew. Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, he had learned how to pack.
What do you remember? Well, let's take these folks one at a time. You had mentioned Dave Smith. Was Dave the trail crew foreman?
No, he was the packer. Richard Hansen was the trail crew foreman.
Okay, so Richard would have just shown up. Is that right?
I guess.
Okay.
And see, usually you work YACC for a year, and then they decide whether they're picking you up or not.
Okay.
As a seasonal.
All right. And so working YCC, were they actually giving you like a food and a place to stay but no pay? Or were they actually giving you some sort of stipend?
I think it might have been minimum wage.
Okay.
And then, yeah, we had a place to stay. There was a cook. And there might have been a small expense for that out of our pay. But I'm pretty sure we were getting, like, minimum wage.
Okay. Yeah, because you're working hard. Trail crew, that's not going to be just out on a rove with the radio, you know, as a backcountry interp ranger or a backcountry trails ranger. You know, it's much more physical.
Yeah, which I liked,
mm-hmm.
that part.
Okay. Okay, so Richard, let's start with Richard then.
Okay.
He was a foreman, and we Richard and I have just been doing some oral history work, and I'm trying to think. I think he had applied to be just on the trail crew, and they offered him the foreman job. and he took it, and it took him a while, but he eventually got things figured out and started to excel there, which was really neat for his story. What do you remember about him? That first winter when you met him.
Mostly, we would just see him at the very beginning of the tour, And then we would go usually into the canyon for, we were like 9 days on and five off.
Okay.
And so at the very beginning, it was basically Pete Howard was like my supervisor that I considered. So I knew Richard was the foreman. But I, you know, slowly got to know. He would come out and sometimes on, and you know, just check us out on this on the crew. And
okay.
So he took a liking to me, and usually, like I say, usually stayed on YACC for a year. And he picked me up as a seasonal after like 6 months.
Okay.
So that was pretty nice because that was a big boost in pay.
Would you have been like a GS-3 or 4, something like that?
That was WG.
Okay, wage grade.
Yeah, so I don't know if that was a 2 or a 3 at that point. I don't remember.
Okay. And that would have been in the spring of 80?
Yeah, or summer of 80.
And those details, as a seasonal, that's got a start date and a good fixed end date for so many months.
Yeah, and at that point, you know, we were working 11-month seasons.
Oh, wow.
So yeah,
so was so, that was that two seasons back-to-back, two seasonal, I don't know what the word I'm looking for, assignments, I guess?
I don't think so. I think it was just that this was before they really cut everything down, so they didn't have to pay yet.
Okay.
After 6 months, but it was 11 months.
Okay.
And I think my month off was sometime in the winter. So I would, that was probably one of those times I flew back and got my Volkswagen and drove it back out.
Okay.
But yeah, I remember
so,
when that was.
So tell me about Pete Howard.
Well, Pete, pretty much, Pete and Stanley both pretty much taught me about the mules and how to be around them and how to pack them. And they were patient with me. Stanley, sometimes he liked you to struggle. But I, you know, I have a habit of asking a lot of questions, so and he would answer them.
Okay.
But so first off, I was in the dirt pit, you know, so basically I was just riding, you know, saddling my saddle mule and then the string, the dirt haulers, putting the boxes on them. And then I was the one left in the pit. Stanley and Tillman were the dirt haulers. And my job was to mound up two big mounds of dirt where the mule would walk in the middle of them, and then Stanley and Tillman would shovel the boxes full, and then while they were gone dumping the string, I'd have to work my piles back up.
Okay.
So,
and you'd have to find a pit somewhere. This is in the Grand Canyon where there's lots of cliffs and big rocks and not
yeah.
a lot of dirt. And they were taking yeah. this dirt down and dumping it on the trails to keep
yeah.
the trails kind of smooth?
Yep. So we would also put a base of rock down.
Okay.
So,
like a base of crushed rock?
Yeah, when we were doing the crushing.
So this is you and a 3-pound sledgehammer or a 5-pound sledgehammer and a large rock.
I always picked the 8-pound.
Okay.
So yeah, so there would be people like below the trail throwing rocks up, and then there'd be people smashing them, making small rocks out of big ones.
My sense is that this was a year in, year out operation that went forever.
It did.
And one kind of stands back and goes, is this standard practice for trail building? Isn't there a better way? But I guess there isn't.
Well, it was like as soon as you're done, you're starting over because you got, the Fred Harvey mules are coming down and they were doing, gosh, I can't remember. There were at least one trip to Bright Angel and or out to the point there.
Plateau Point.
And that was the day trip, and then they did overnight trips where they'd go down the Bright Angel and up the Kaibab. So, there was quite a bit of mule traffic going on, and then
right.
And then us.
And all the, and foot traffic, it's probably not that hard on the trails, but the mule traffic would be.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
let's back up a little bit. What do you remember about Tillman?
He was quiet. He and Stanley were both quiet, but he was very accomplished with the mules.
Okay.
And he was somebody that I definitely looked up to and watched how he worked around them.
Okay.
They went after, it seems like Tillman left, and that was just Stanley at some point. But, and then we had different Hopis on the crew.
Okay, and Candido, what do you remember about Candido?
Candido was just the sweetest thing. So, I think I had dinner with his family one Christmas.
No.
Pretty interesting. But,
nice.
I loved all those guys.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so were you, do you think you were the first trail crew female working at Grand Canyon?
I don't know. There was a couple of more after me, I know, because Richard was very open to hiring women.
Mm-hmm. And First Nations people, people of color. He was not trapped in the color bar land.
No, he wasn't. And so he was, he would hire women. They usually didn't last all that long that I remember. My friend Sue was on for a while, but she ended up getting a maintenance job and decided she was going to do that.
Okay.
And then there was a gal named Chris, I think. She ended up going to nursing school. So.
Okay.
I was the one that just liked busting rocks, I guess. But
it's a temperament kind of job, and if you have the right temperament, boy, it's a wonderful job.
Well, and then I just learned so much about, building these trails up and building rock walls and then we did some pavement stuff on the rims and
talk
and
to me can you talk to me about what it means to fall in love with a rock?
Well, you look for special rocks for walls, and then even if you're doing, we would have a punjar drill and feather and wedges and split our own rocks sometimes.
Okay.
But it was just fun. I had fun doing that.
How do you work a feather and a wedge? Can you describe the tools that you've got for that and how it works?
Well, the punjar had drill attachment, so you drill holes, say, in a line of where you wanted the rock to crack.
Okay.
And then you would put the feathers in with the wedge in between them. And I'd fill up all my holes, and then I'd kind of go down the way, hitting the wedges with sledgehammer until it started cracking open.
Okay. And were you looking for certain types of rock? I'm thinking maybe coconino, you know, sandstone.
Yeah, it was mainly sand. That busted easiest.
Okay, yeah. That's spelled C O C O N I N O, coconino. Sandstone. But the sandstone, that's only up in the upper third up there, and you needed it down canyon.
Yeah, but there was some red and what, you know, like in the red and white switchbacks.
Mm-hmm. So. On the Kaibab Trail.
So, and then, but there was a dirt pit. Is that Windy Ridge on the Kaibab?
Top of the red wall?
Yeah.
Around the corner out of sight?
Yeah.
Yep.
That was my first dirt pit.
Okay.
And so we would haul out of there. And then when we got down far enough, I think we moved. We had to move somewhere down closer to Phantom, and then we'd start working out of there.
Okay. Yeah, it's a funny deal to actually run a mine for dirt in the Grand Canyon to put on the trails.
Yeah, I don't suppose they're doing that anymore.
I'm not so sure they're not. I don't know. It was going on for a long time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And then when Stanley and Tillman went on their furlough, I asked Pete if I could do the dirt hauling.
Okay.
And he let me. So he would haul dirt with me, just kind of show me the ropes. And then, yeah.
Cool.
So I ended up getting pretty good at shoveling.
So you were shoveling in the pit. You're digging up the dirt, and that's with a pick and a bar, and you're trying to build up these piles as quick as you can, because those guys are going to come back. Now you're one of them, which means you bring your string in between these two piles of dirt, and you shovel one pannier full, and then go around the mule, and then shovel the other side full.
No, there's two people. No.
Okay.
You'd be in big trouble. You got to shovel at the same time.
Okay, so the load is uniformly distributed on the mule.
Yep.
Okay.
And then you gotta pull the pins at the same time too to dump it.
Oh. Okay. So, and so you'd stand there and look at each other and say, "Ready, set, go."
Yep. Pretty much.
Okay. And then you'd have a bunch of dirt at your feet. And then you'd go mule by mule by mule and do that down the line.
Uh-huh.
And then
we'd unhook them. They're all hooked together. So the last mule loaded is the first one dumped.
Okay.
And you know, like if I was riding drag, which I usually was, I would be back, you know, like a string's worth, and then I'd come up and we'd take the last mule and usually turning sideways in the trail, perpendicular, so that all of it would land in the middle of the trail.
That makes sense, sure.
And then go and tie him, you know, once he was empty, tie him to, like, my ride.
Okay.
And then we'd get the next one. And we'd go down like that until everybody was dumped, and then we'd try and do, you know, then whoever was riding drag on the way in is now hauling the mules back to the pit, and the one who had brought the mules in is now riding drag, and he's doing a quick raking the dirt out.
Okay.
And then we go back for another load.
And how many mules in a string between your mule you were riding and your partner's mule they were riding?
There's five dirt haulers generally.
Okay.
Maybe six sometimes.
Okay.
And then our two rides. So 7 to 8 mules altogether.
Yeah, okay. And then so the lead becomes the drag and has to knock down the dirt that was dumped out of the, so that's a lot of work there, just trying to knock that down a little bit while you're trying to keep up with the string as it starts heading out toward the pit again.
Yeah, well, you have a little bit of time because you go into the pit and tie up, and then you get the last mule and start it all over again.
Right. Was there a fourth person? I'm thinking there's a digger in the pit.
Yeah, there's a lot of times there's two diggers.
Two diggers in a pit. Were there any spreaders out working on the trail with the crushed rock, or did you all just leave the pit dirt spreading and all go and crush rock for a while?
We try and get the rock crushed, have an area ready for dirt, and then we haul the dirt over it.
All right.
And later on, we had a machine, a rock crushing machine. It seemed like it was always breaking down. So.
Yeah, and you had to get rock into it, which was bigger.
And it was noisy. Yep. And then we had to get it off the trail for the dude strings to come by.
Right.
So it was actually more of a pain than helpful.
Okay.
But we'd have the poon jar in the pit and kind of blading down dirt off the bank.
And that's a gas-powered vibratory monster that weighs probably 50, maybe 60 pounds, I'm thinking. It's got a gasoline engine, and it's like a mechanical pick, if you will. It's just got a sharp tip on it.
And so we would use it for, because, you know, we also ditched on the inside of the trails.
Okay.
We would line the trails with rock, and the trail is 4 feet wide, the length of our shovel handle. And then we could take the poon jar and blade out the dirt for an inside ditch, and then somebody's using the poon jar and somebody's digging out the ditch and throwing it on the trail.
Okay. Because that was good dirt you could recycle.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Well, I've got a ton of questions, but we've been at this for an hour.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if this is a good time to put a comma on this. And we'll come back and pick it up again, because I want to know about your housing, and I want to know about other types of wall work and other, you know, what happens when the hikers got in trouble, and, you know, did you break away to help them, and just the other, you know, the other parts of the job. And what was your family thinking? If that sounds like a good idea, then maybe we'll just put a comma here and pick it up again.
Okay, sounds good.
All right. Well, with that, this will conclude what I'm going to call part one of an oral history interview with Claire Donato. Today is Wednesday, November 18th, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. And Claire, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.